Since for the Greeks, political life by definition did not extend beyond the walls of the polis, the use of violence seemed to them beyond the need for justification in the realm of what we today call foreign affairs or international relations, even though their foreign affairs, with the one exception of the Persian Wars, which saw all Hellas united, concerned hardly more than relations between Greek cities. Outside the walls of the polis, that is, outside the realm of politics in the Greek sense of the word, the strong did what they could, and the weak suffered what they must. Thucydides. Hence, we must turn to Roman antiquity to find the first justification of war, together with the first notion that there are just and unjust wars. Yet the Roman distinctions and justifications were not concerned with freedom and drew no line between aggressive and defensive warfare. "The war that is necessary is just," said Livy, "and hallowed are the arms where no hope exists but in them. Justum enim est bellum quibus necessarium, et pia arma ubi nulla nisi in armis spes est." Necessity, since the time of Livy and through the centuries, has meant many things that we today would find quite sufficient to double war unjust rather than just. Conquest, expansion, defense of vested interests, conservation of power in view of the rise of new and threatening powers, or support of a given power equilibrium. All these well-known realities of power politics were not only actually the causes of the outbreak of most wars in history, they were also recognized as necessities, that is, as legitimate motives to invoke a decision by arms. The notion that aggression is a crime, and that wars can be justified only if they ward off aggression or prevent it, acquired its practical and even theoretical significance only after the First World War had demonstrated the horribly destructive potential of warfare under conditions of modern technology. Perhaps it is because of this noticeable absence of the freedom argument from the traditional justifications of war as the last resort of international politics that we have this curiously jarring sentiment whenever we hear it introduced into the debate of the war question today. To sound off with a cheerful "give me liberty or give me death" sort of argument in the face of the unprecedented and inconceivable potential of destruction in nuclear warfare is not even hollow. It is downright ridiculous. Indeed, it seems so obvious that it is a very different thing to risk one's own life for the life and freedom of one's country and one's posterity from risking the very existence of the human species for the same purpose, that it is difficult not to suspect the defenders of the "better dead than red" or "better death than slavery" slogans of bad faith. Which, of course, is not to say the reverse, "better red than dead," has any more to recommend itself. When an old truth ceases to be applicable, it does not become any truer by being stood on its head. As a matter of fact, to the extent that the discussion of the war question today is conducted in these terms, it is easy to detect a mental reservation on both sides. Those who say "better dead than red" actually think, "the losses may not be as great as some anticipate, our civilization will survive." While those who say "better red than dead" actually think, "slavery will not be so bad, man will not change his nature, freedom will not vanish from the earth forever." In other words, the bad faith of the discussants lies in that both dodge the preposterous alternative they themselves have proposed. They are not serious. It is important to remember that the idea of freedom was introduced into the debate of the war question after it had become quite obvious that we had reached a stage of technical development where the means of destruction were such as to exclude their rational use. In other words, freedom has appeared in this debate like a deus ex machina to justify what on rational grounds has become unjustifiable. Is it too much to read into the current, rather hopeless confusion of issues and arguments a hopeful indication that a profound change in international relations may be about to occur? Namely, the disappearance of war from the scene of politics, even without a radical transformation of international relations, and without an inner change of men's hearts and minds? Could it not be that our present perplexity in this matter indicates our lack of preparedness for a disappearance of war, our inability to think in terms of foreign policy, without having in mind this continuation with other means as its last resort? Quite apart from the threat of total annihilation, which conceivably could be eliminated by new technical